Welcome back to Upon This Land, History, Mystery, and Monuments. My name's Dustin Baker, and I'm the Chief of Interpretation here at George Washington Birthplace National Monument. George Washington was born in 1732, but the Washington story began here in the 1640s when the Pope family moved across the Potomac and settled in Virginia. Nathaniel Pope and the early settlers of today's Westmoreland County set the stage for the arrival of John Washington, the first Washington to immigrate to Virginia, and who would become the great-grandfather of George. To help us learn more about the society John arrived in and the society he helped to build, we're joined again by Dr. Philip Levy.
So he's a guy whose life was defined by the crises, the English crisis of the 1640s. That is the pivotal central event in his life that sets him on a trajectory. People have liked the fact that Nathaniel Pope got balled up in the rebellions against Maryland, because you can read people wanting to sort of project a kind of genetic revolutionary quality. You know, here's like George Washington's great, 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 and he was a rebel. So, you know, ergo, people want to do this kind of projection, you know, and it's fantasy, but it's, you know, it has a certain charm, certain literary symmetry, even though they're not parallel cases. They don't mean the same thing. It doesn't really mean much. And it ignores a lot of English history and a lot of American history in order to do that. But John Washington Senior, the one we're talking about, absolutely, his trajectory is defined by these events. That's because his father, Lawrence, and once again, these guys have this habit of just, you know, the Washingtons use the name John and Lawrence over and over and over again. But his father, Lawrence, was a clerk, was a minister, a cleric, and was very well positioned, very well connected. And he got caught up in the conflicts of the 1640s. And ended up with the position at Oxford, where he was sort of there to keep Puritans out. That was kind of his job. So he's a real loyalist to the crown and to the Anglican Church. And he's there to sort of swat back Puritans and make sure that they don't end up in the faculty, they don't end up getting ministerial certifications, because this is very much a conflict about how the church is going to be run. So he's in that position, and when the parliamentarians, when the crown sort of fails, and you get new parliament authority, they start enacting revenge. And one of the people who gets caught up in the revenge of the parliamentarians is Lawrence Washington, who loses his position at Oxford, and is given sort of a little crap parish, right? And sort of is not a wealthy man and sort of marginal, and that sort of, you know, shapes his world. And John and his brother Lawrence are caught up in this. So these are young men who, had there not been the English Civil War, they would have gone to Oxford. He would have been, presumably would have picked up exactly where his father was and become, you know, a man of letters, been, you know, a cleric and maybe had held the same position. Who knows who he would have been, right? But that doesn't happen. Instead, his father loses his position and ends up in a poor parish. And both of the sons are forced to kind of go find a way to make a living, particularly after their father passed away. They now have to figure out what they're going to do. And both of them go to London and apprentice themselves. So completely different trajectory. And in John's case, he apprenticed himself into the world of merchant houses. So he learns to become a merchant. Now, we need to clarify that, because I think it's too easy to misunderstand the 17th century. Being able to write clearly in a good, clear hand, being able to compose a letter well that's comprehensible and literary, being able to do sums, being able to handle basic bookkeeping, and understanding sort of the basics of commerce, those are specialized skills. That's not something people just learned in elementary school. Wealthy elites will learn things like writing, but most people, non-elite people, you have to learn that. And those are the skills of being a merchant. And that's what you learn when you learn the business of being a merchant, the workings. You also learn these details of how to write a good letter, how to balance books, specialized skills. And John Washington had those. So he attached himself to a firm run by a guy named Prescott. And Prescott's brother-in-law, Miras, I think, is Prescott's brother-in-law. And we don't know the details because we don't have a lot of records. Everything we know comes from one court case, and it's all third hand. So, you know, we don't get a lot. Nobody outlines this. But John attached himself to this firm, and the first thing he did for that firm was go to Poland and then to Denmark on a tobacco mission. So he's working in the world of tobacco merchants. What's happening is Virginia tobacco is being packed up, is grown and packed in Virginia, and then shipped to European markets. Goes to English markets, but not everybody's going to the English market. There are also people who are selling in the continental markets. And there's the sort of remnants of the Hanseatic League, this old trade along the Baltic that sort of links these different ports together. There's a long-established world of trade there, and the English and the Dutch in the 16th and 17th centuries are breaking into that. So it's kind of a growing market for English and Dutch merchants. And there's all sorts of woolens and furs and, you know, all sorts of stuff that moves along those markets. And tobacco is a commodity. So there's a market for tobacco in Poland and the Denmark and anywhere along the Baltic. So Prescott seems to be operating in that market. And so Washington went first to Poland and then to Denmark. And he goes, we know that he was in Copenhagen, and he went up to Helsingør, up at the top. That's where Hamlet takes place. And he went, so he's going up the peninsula on an errand. So he's fairly low in the hierarchy. His job is what was called at the time a supercargo, meaning that it's kind of what it sounds like. He's the superintendent of the cargo. So he's not a sailor. Sailors are a thing unto themselves. That's a whole other training that you have, and you can't fake that. You either know how to do this stuff or you don't. You either know how to tie complicated knots with one hand and know how to climb the rigging, and your hands will reflect that you know how to do that because they're going to be calloused and blackened from tar. You can't pretend to be a sailor. And if you did not come up in the world of ships and go through an apprenticeship on a ship, you're not a sailor. So he's not a sailor. He's a merchant. But he's not a financial backer. He's not an investor. He's an employee. And the job is the supercargo. He's the guy who sort of is in charge of making sure that everything's handled well with the cargo. So as he's going up Denmark, he's on a merchant's errand. He's either making arrangements for delivery of tobacco, or he's picking up payments for tobacco. It's hard to tell what he's doing. He ends up, though, from there on another vessel called the Seahorse that went to Virginia with Prescott. And they went into the Chesapeake and up to the Potomac. So Prescott knows where he's going. He's got this all worked out. Long-standing trade networks, long-standing alliances. And he ends up, it's hard to tell exactly where they are, but they're probably at the head of Maddox, or sorry, at the mouth of Maddox Creek. And again, it's hard to know what's happening, but one thing we do know, the standard practice, is the tobacco loading season, when the shipping goes out, is the winter. It takes all year to do this, and the shipments go out in the winter. So the tobacco fleet, the boats that are going to come in and get the tobacco barrels and then bring them back to Europe, that's all happening in the winter. So they're there in the winter. And something went wrong. There are a few things that go wrong, but Washington... It's the first thing that goes wrong is that, it's not the first thing, but it's the most important thing, that their ship sinks. Right? So fully loaded, and it sinks. And they probably hit a shoal. So the river shoals are always changing. The Potomac is a little turbulent, but it's also really cold. And so when they try to haul the cargo out, there's ice on the ropes. They lose the boats that they try to rescue with. It's just a really, it's a mess. It's a really bad thing. And then when they're able to bring the barrels up, sort of salvage the barrels of tobacco, they're all ruined. So they just have to get rid of it. So the whole cargo's lost. Like everything, all the investment's gone, all wasted. It's a big deal. Not a happy occasion. And if you think about Washington, like sort of beginning this voyage in London, going to Poland and then to Denmark, and now he's in Virginia, and then he's like trying to haul tobacco barrels out of the water. It's like this isn't good. This isn't a good experience. Now, there are several different ways that people market tobacco at the time or conduct this trade. And one of the ways you do it is you have a long-term relationship with a tobacco planter, or several, enough to fill your hold. So you know you're going to be going back to a particular set of planters next because you've got a business relationship with them. Another way that people do this is they put someone in Virginia to kind of act as their agent on the ground. And it might be that that's what John was going to be, that he was going to be Prescott's agent in Virginia, because he gets there and he decides to stay. Now, why does he decide to stay? Was that always the plan, that he was going to be an on-site agent who was going to sort of, you know, handle the business on the Virginia side? It's also possible that he found that he really hated being at sea. I mean, that's a long experience, and, you know, he just might decide he's done with this. There may have been conflicts, personal conflicts between him and Prescott that we just don't see. We know that they went to court, so that, you know, that doesn't have to be read as animus, but it's not good. Romantics have wanted to invent that he fell in love with Daniel Pope's daughter. So you have this romantic edge. That's probably the least credible of all of these explanations. But there's business opportunity here. But Nathaniel Pope becomes very important here because he sees in John Washington an opportunity. And it's significant that Pope had the money to set himself up in Maryland, was called Mr., so he's a gentleman by title, but he doesn't seem to know how to sign his name. So he might not have been fully literate. But here comes John Washington, trained as a merchant who can write letters, who can do sums, and more than that, can teach Pope's children to do that. So he can act as a tutor who can teach Nathaniel Jr. and Thomas how to do these things also, who are both, they're still minors. He can teach them. It's a very valuable skill set. And very quickly, Pope and Washington form an alliance. And the alliance crystallizes in John Washington marrying Ann Pope. So Washington kind of walked into this world, or floated into this world, and immediately married the daughter of the wealthiest man, most influential man in that little corner of the colony. And immediately sort of steps right into that role. What's interesting is that the whole thing comes to a loss. The whole issue with him and Prescott comes to a lawsuit, which is how we know the details. And that had to just be great, because prominent men step forward. I mean, this is a guy who's just a merchant, but he's got prominent men backing him. Washington asked for his pay from Prescott, which, of course, makes perfect sense. People have misread this. And again, there's this projection. The same romantic mind that thought that he saw Ann Washington, you know, standing in front of the house and said, you know, that is my future. Like, none of that happened. But that the same romantic mind has wanted John to have been a partner in the firm. And the language of the court case leads to that confusion, but he's not the partner. And what he's asking for is the settling of the account, meaning he wants to pay. The role, like I say, is supercargo. We know this role. But the crucial thing is that the way we know that he's not a partner is when they bring the barrels up. The barrels are marked with with Prescott's name, but they're not Washington's name. So the barrels will always be marked with the partnership name. The sailors, if there are seven barrels, one of those barrels belongs to the sailors. And they will get the value of that barrel as their pay. So they have an investment in this. The rest will belong to the partners. The partners will get the wealth, and then they will pay their employee the supercargo. So John Washington doesn't have anything with his name on that vessel. He's owed money. And right as he sees his employers basically having lost the entire cargo, he's like, all right, that's your problem. You still owe me money for the services I rendered, right? So he takes them to court to try to get that money. And Nathaniel Pope is right there with him, like backing him up. And he's got some other people, too, who are like prominent men who are stepping forward to support John Washington. So he's very appealing. There's something they see in him. I think it's his skill that he brings two things. He brings that merchant skill. He knows how to write. He knows how to, cipher. He knows how to do the books. He also brings London connections, because he's connected to the world of London merchants. He's very alluring. So you create an advantageous marriage. You link him into your family, and off you go. And so that's where we are by 1660. Then Nathaniel Pope passes away. Both of his sons are still minors. So John Washington is left as the guardian of these two minor sons. He's got his wife and the acreage. So he suddenly becomes Nathaniel Pope. Nathaniel Pope did all the groundwork and then obligingly passed away. And John Washington sort of steps right in. It's like, I'll take it from here, father-in-law. And continues to grow and, you know, by force of will becomes, you know, a very prominent person in the area.
Hey everyone, this is Dustin cutting in. We're about to hear about some of the many different roles John Washington had in his community. And I want to warn our listeners that this segment includes some graphic material, including the topic of suicide.
John Washington was a justice of the peace, meaning he sat on the county court because he was the literate person who could, write in a legible hand, and knew how to spell words, knew how to do these things that are special skills. He would be asked to do a variety of different jobs. That's normal, right? And you want to be asked to do these jobs. That's part of being a gentryman. And one of the jobs that he gets that's wildly misunderstood, right? Just there are two positions that get misunderstood when people look back at the colonial records. One of them is attorney. And being an attorney in our world does not mean what it meant to these guys. There certainly are people who get like a little bit of legal training, and there are people in Virginia who had legal training. So they're there. But somebody is your attorney when you ask them to act as your agent in a court case. And the only reason you might ask them to do that is because they either are better connected than you are, or they know the law better than you do, or they write better than you do. So you get a lot of these guys who act as an attorney for a neighbor, right? Meaning they represent them in court. But like genealogies and ancestors will say, and he was an attorney. Like, no, he wasn't an attorney. Like, he's a farmer. He's a farmer who went to court and represented his friend. So this word attorney gets given this like weight that it really sort of doesn't deserve in most cases. Well, there's another one that's even stranger, and that's the job of coroner. A coroner is a member of the county court who's commissioned to do an investigation of a suspicious death. It's not a full-time position. They're not medical doctors. They have no medical training whatsoever. They're farmers who are on the county court who are given a position of responsibility, in this case being a coroner. Well, there's an instance or two instances where John Washington is asked to be a coroner. And you can find people in the Romantic days who are trying to, because what they wanted to do was, manifest George Washington's greatness somehow in his ancestors. So they would just puff up any achievement of these guys. John Washington went to war and he was a coroner. Like, no, he wasn't a coroner. He had the role of coroner in two cases. He doesn't know anything about the physical body. But he's a trusted source who can look at a case and make an evaluation. So there's a guy named William Freak with an E at the end. And he's a small landholder, one of the early patent holders from the 1650s, over on Maddox Creek, it's off the Jiwa land, but he's there before John Washington, and he's there during John Washington. And at some point, I don't remember the date, it's the 60s, sometime in the 60s, he has a servant, William Freak does, who waded out into Maddox Creek and drowned himself. So it's a suicide. Now, there's any number of reasons this would have happened, and nobody's really that concerned about the reason it happened in the 1650s, or 60s, sorry. That's not really what they're going to lose sleep about. They just want to understand what happened, not why. And John Washington's the coroner in that case, and he conducts an investigation, and it ends up in the county records. And his investigation is that this was what they called at the time self-murder, which is a crime. It's still a crime. It's a complicated crime. The crime resonates more for them than it does for us. They are very worried that a sort of melancholia would spread over the servile labor force. They don't want their servants killing themselves. They have an investment in them. They don't want this to happen. So they have an interest in stopping this. It also has a spiritual dimension that scares them and is very much part of their understanding of the world. And so when John Washington concluded that that this was a self-murder, the servant is then buried at a crossroad near Maddox Bridge with a spike driven in him. So those classic vampire burials, a person who has committed self-murder is buried outside of sacred ground with a spike driven through them. And so that person, whoever they were, we don't know their name, it's never recorded, was buried is still out there, presumably. You know, the roads haven't changed all that much, but that person was buried up there, and John Washington oversaw that investigation and that burial. And that speaks to place in a really interesting way, because it shows in a where there's the places people are supposed to be buried when they die in good status, if that's how we want to phrase it, versus people who are problematic. And everybody in the area would have known about this. They all would know. This is a place that people pass over regularly. They would know this. So John Washington becomes very active in the church. The parish is named after him, like in his lifetime. It gets called Washington Parish, which is really quite a thing. And then, you know, if you had any doubt about his convictions, his will is a masterpiece. It's, you know, George Washington's will begins, I believe it's like in the name of Godfather and Godfather Amen, right? That kind of thing. Augustine Washington, George's father, same kind of thing. John Washington's will is like this long Anglican preamble. I mean, it's like an exercise in Anglican theology. It's phenomenal. It's great. But he just like lays out, you know, the path for salvation and how salvation works through the church. And he really cares about this stuff. Like, this is serious business to him. And of course, you'd imagine that he would. I mean, his father, you know, suffered literally for the benefit of the Anglican church, right? So he does not take this lightly. This is serious business to him. And so he's on the vestry of establishing this church. And when he passed away, he left in his will that there would be money for a sermon, which is a common thing to do in his memory, and money for two objects that he would leave in the church. And one of them is the Ten Commandments, and the other is the royal crest. So, like, there it is. Like, he wants you to be in that church looking at the royal crest, because he is completely in on the Anglican church. That's who John Washington is. So, you know, at that level, that's who he is. He's obviously involved in a whole bunch of colonial affairs. He's very prominent in the in the lead up to the Indian Wars in the 1670s. He arguably is instrumental in bringing on that conflict when they went up to the Susquehannock Fort, immediately opposite Mount Vernon, and besieged it for a month or more, and then the whole enterprise kind of fell apart. So it's one and only military enterprise and doesn't go very well. It's paralleled in George Washington's early military escapades also being failures. People have seen a parallel there. John's a land acquirer, so he acquired the land of Mount Vernon. I mean, he's sort of opposite it and says, well, I'll patent that too and get about 2,000 acres of land there that stays in the family all the way through. He acquired lots of land near where he was living on Maddox Creek. He acquired the old Nanzatico land. He was given the right to take the Nanzatico Indians' land once they weren't there anymore, which of course only creates incentive to make sure they're not there anymore, which is what happened. He ends up claiming the Nanzatico's land. And then during Bacon's Rebellion, true to form, he stays loyal. He's a loyalist to Governor Berkeley, which is, again, an echo of the Anglican establishment. He, as things got bad, he either went to Maryland or to the Eastern Shore. We're not sure exactly where, but we know he left because people talk about him. They pack up a boat and he goes. So, yeah, so he is. I don't think we can understand him without understanding what got Nathaniel Pope to be who he is, because he steps in and takes that handoff and then builds on it and creates what begins to be the basis for the Washington family fortune that's going to lead to an extremely wealthy family with an enormous amount of local prominence.
Thank you for joining us on this episode of Upon This Land, History, Mystery, and Monuments. October is Archaeology Month in Virginia, and our next episode is one you won't want to miss. In 2022, Building X, a significant archaeological feature in the memorial area of the park, was reopened for modern analysis. What did we learn about it? Find out on our next episode.